WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We got a Baltimore Positive segment here. Before we do that, I got to tell you about the ice cream that I am out of right now. This is the old label Chocolate Love from our friends at Taharka, serving up the chocolate love as well as the ice cream love. And Don Moeller's probably running out of his peanut butter cup or his mint flicks and chills right now. You can order Taharka. You can find Taharka. They will bring it to you, and it can be found anywhere here in Baltimore, made in Baltimore with love. Last time we were with this guy, we were having shrimp and grits out at State Fair. He is a Fadley's veteran as well. This is the kind of guy we'd be having at both of our sponsor locations if we did not have COVID, but he's down on the Eastern Shore staying safe through all of this. Don Moeller, as a former Baltimore County executive yourself, and as a kid who once campaigned against our next guest back in 1974-76, I want you to introduce our next guest, who is a recurring theme here at Baltimore Positive, right?
Absolutely. Ted Venatoulis, one of the most respected, really, former elected officials, a journalist, somebody who's just been involved in the Maryland political scene for decades, and no one is more astute. And Ted continues to be prolific with his commentaries that appear regularly with our friends at Center Maryland. So, Ted, there's nothing going on, so welcome back to Baltimore
Right. A storm, a pandemic, engaged president, being gentle there. Viruses, I mean, nothing's going on. You're right, Don.
Well, Ted, go ahead,
Nestor.
Well, we've spent so much time. We had Jim Smith on a couple weeks ago. We've just talked about the role of government during crisis, right? And go back to your time and the times that you've lived through when you were publishing at the Towson Times and opining, and you're still opining on all of this. But can we just go back to the general role of government, that you're the county executive back in the 70s and some plague comes, you know, to White Marsh at that point, and you're running the government, the challenges, or when a storm comes through, and as we're taping this, a tropical whatever remnants of Isaias is coming through right now. This is where people count on government.
And Don,
right?
That is the functioning of government. That's when folks, citizens, voters, taxpayers expect the government to function. They have no other alternative. They can't do it individually when they've got a storm like this or a hurricane or any other kind of danger. The government has to step in. That's one of the reasons we have it. And usually, I think in Baltimore County, we've always done a pretty good job, whether it's snow or whether it's crime or whether it's a hurricane. I think we've been well equipped to handle them. Don, I don't know how you feel, but I always felt comfortable with our guys, the police, the firefighters, the first responders, the medical community. This particular crisis, the virus has stretched everybody. And because it's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime thing, it's difficult to really handle. One of the things it does require, and where the government, I think, and I think a lot of professionals feel, has let us down, is on a national level. This is the kind of thing that needs a very hefty coordination among some of the bigger agencies that have the resources and the manpower to command some kind of national unity. The states, of course, and the local subdivisions, it's always been involved in education, particularly the local subdivisions. We've always let the school system run locally. We've always avoided federal intrusion and interference. So in that regard, it's still very difficult. Let me frame it this way. Even with our school system, not to have some kind of national purpose. Mostly because of the way everyone is transported. We're all moving from place to place. We're at the beach for the summer. We're here. We go to ball games. We do this. We do grocery shopping. And you travel from place to place. So we really could use some standardization, even with schooling, because the kids just don't go to school. They come home, parents, grandparents. And we all have the potential of carrying. This thing is vicious. I know too many people that have had it, and it's not something you want to get. It really transforms the body into some total illness and non-functioning. And so anyhow, this is a kind of crisis that really tests us. And so far, I don't think we've met the test. So anyhow, that's to me, Nestor, Don, the purpose of government is to take us through these situations. Wars, conflicts, crises, storms. You know, that's what we're hoping a government can do for us. So,
well, Ted, you've made a decision, and I'll put it that way, and then you can react. You've made a decision to not sit on the sidelines, and you've made a decision to be very, very vocal about the actions of this president. Some of your friends have pushed back and said, Ted, you're being too hard on the president. Tell us and our listeners why you've chosen to be as outspoken as you have at this point in our nation's history.
Well, you're right about that, Don. I have. People who know me know that I've had a pretty moderate rhetorical sense, that I've been careful in terms of how I deal with people and issues. Particularly when you're in government, I've always felt it, and I know you felt the same way, as is Kevin and all of our executives, that after you're elected, you are the representative of all the people, not just those who voted for you. You have a responsibility for everybody, and therefore you have to have some kind of tempered view on how you respond, even with the members of the opposition. In fact, I always felt that a loyal opposition is an essential ingredient of a government and of our democratic politics. They kept me straight. I mean, they would argue with me and present some things, and never mind internally, where you always wanted to. I always wanted people around me who were smarter than I was, because that's how you learn. But today, I made a decision. And it didn't come easily, that I would stop arguing with friends who had a different view. It became apparent to me that I had a difficult time in persuading them or even discussing with them, because there seemed to be such a cultish feeling about him, which was disturbing. And I think that came from the top. So I decided I'm not in office. Maybe I have some talent as a writer and a speaker, and so I would start speaking out. And I have. And those who read my material realize, and it's a contradiction of my general nature. I'm a reasonably pleasant person, I think. Funny sometimes. Sometimes I think I'm funny, and I'm not. At least that's what
Lynn?
My...
Does Lynn think you're funny?
Well, no, sometimes. I was going to say, my family and my daughter say, you're not being funny, Dad. You know, it's always humbling to know that. But in any event, I decided that we have to speak out. And here's one of the reasons. First, never mind that the behavior of this particular president is so unusual, so bizarre, so unhinged, and you can go on and on. They're just things that don't make any sense in the way our democracy is functioning. It's a violation of many of our norms. For example, you just can't go breaking trees. Most treaties have been taken years to develop. You can't just go shaking up policies with some flip executive order. Some of these policies have taken years and compromise and give and take. Over the years to come to a conclusion, and to simply wipe them off the map because this is what you want to do, well, you're not educated. And by the way, I think one of the problems with our incumbent president is he's not educated. I don't think he really knows who the members of NATO are. I don't think he knows what the Baltic area is. I don't think he has an appreciation of the Higher Education Act or civil rights legislation, voting rights, how all this emerged and developed. And I think that's a real problem. He doesn't know what he's talking about. and that is evident by his rambling. Listen to him talk about an answer to a question, and then listen to somebody like Nancy Pelosi or Adam Schiff or your previous guest, Jamie Raskin, answer a question. It's loaded with substantive material, with data. This fella is all over the place, very little data, and the data that he has is usually the result of a conspiracy theory of some nature. I mean, he was going to give people Lysol or bleach. I mean, who says that? Who? I mean, not a 10-year-old. I mean, and that's just a simple example of the kind of nefarious things that flow from his mouth. I mean, so anyhow, I decided I couldn't just let this happen in spite of whatever conflict I might start in friends and other people. But here's the most important reason. It is people like us who raise doubt, who criticize, who try to correct statements or policies. There are people like ourselves who challenge the incumbency of this president that allow for so many others to sit comfortably in their offices, in their wherever they are in their homes, to sit comfortably behind some issue of impartiality or indifference, while this guy is rattling on and developing paramilitary things. It makes it possible for them to live their lives without the fear of a fascist government. That's what we're doing. We're defending democracy and letting them stay home and be safe and not worry about it. And I don't know that some of these members of the Trump cult appreciate that. They can be a member of a cult because people like us are fighting or resisting his apparently instinctive behavior to become a dictator, a demagogue. I don't understand the guy, quite frankly. His niece understood him. If you read her book, it is a very powerful exposition of a president who is unhinged. He's an inch away. I hate to say this, because who wants to criticize a president like this? I get no joy from it. He's a half an inch away from being nuts. I mean, so, you know, so that's why I do it. I think it's important in democracy for us to challenge someone when you feel strongly that all your experience, all your being says he is leading the country in a direction that is not comfortable for our democracy.
Ted Venatoulis is our guest.
Ted is singing out of your hymnal, is he not?
Well, it is. I mean, you're 86 years old, Ted. I famously sort of campaigned against you when I was 8 years old for John Coulihan, and all these years later.
Yeah, Coulihan had a big following.
Well, you talk about your experience and the wisdom of this and your age. And, I mean, Donald Trump's not all that far from your age at this point. I mean, 10 years behind you. And witnessing all that you've witnessed in life, the virus is something different, and how it's been reacted to with lies for 6 months that, I mean,
yeah.
Look, I was down near your home on the Eastern Shore. My wife and I went down to Dewey Beach for about a day and a half in the middle of the week, very early in June. There was no one down there. It was just opening up, and we saw the Eastern Shore. People were wearing masks for the most part. I went down to North Carolina a couple weeks ago. No one was wearing a mask in early June, and that's when I headed for the hills. Now, we're into August, and I'm like, I'm not going anywhere where people don't respect the virus, and they're going to make a political argument based in nonsense against 100 years of epidemiology and science. And the one thing that I've been talking a lot about this week with my sports guest, Ted, has been the fact that we're opening up sports now. We've seen this Marlins thing and the outbreak. But the science of this and where we were and where Wuhan was 9 months ago, where the meat wagon shows up, everybody shows up in white hazmat suits, that around the world they treated this in a nuclear way. We're treating this like people are having parties trying to get this, Ted. You know, like I cannot imagine anything. I mean, the man who saved my wife's life over in Germany, we're being laughed at around the world as to how we're handling this. And I know you're 86 years to see America getting laughed at, where this clown is standing in front of an Axios reporter saying, last is the new first. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. And Nestor, that's why the problem. We keep saying we, and I keep pundits saying in the Congress, it is a very isolated leadership at the top. It is the president. Many of these folks who aren't wearing masks are not wearing masks because their president has told them not to. And the president has mocked it. And the president refuses on many occasions to listen to his scientists. Now, why would someone not listen to scientists and listen to some female quack, that doctor he quoted, who believes in demons and aliens, that he would say, well, I felt that she was legitimate and other. Who does something like that? Who doesn't have the filters in his own system to determine that that woman was a quack and that some of these conspiracy theories are quacks? Masks do not give you the virus. Not wearing masks might give it to you. Drinking bleach does not wipe out the virus.
Herman Cain died last week, Ted, right? I mean, like, literally, right?
Well, it is we happen to know Tony Fauci. He's been a friend of ours for many years.
You've been good friends for a long time, right?
For a long time. My wife had a health lobbying firm, and she represented all the clinical researchers, the people who are working on this vaccine, and Tony headed that, and they became very close because she was working on the legislation that they needed for the research and the funding, and they're very close. He came to a couple of Oriole games with us. He's a big baseball fan. He didn't throw that ball out well, but I think he let the ball go too soon. And he was a good basketball player, by the way, for particularly small guys like us. Nestor,
I always said, in a 6 foot under league, I'll play in that league. You and me, Ted. I'll be the center.
Right, absolutely right. Well, he captained his team as I did. Small guys like that, us, we never called them point guards. Though. We just call them little guys. You know,
shooters.
That was it. But in any event, he's been to our home. He came to one or two things we had for other people, and he is absolutely not only brilliant. He's got a backbone of steel. This man is a scientist through and through, and he will not allow anything that isn't factual determine his feelings and what he will say. And to ignore him, who is so well respected in his own field, been at it for 50, 60 years, is just appalling. To think that this president thinks he's smarter than the generals, he's smarter than members of the intelligence community, smarter than scientists. The only guy he doesn't seem to think he's smarter than is Putin. Where does this come from? Where did he get all this? What is really appalling to me, again, I get no joy out of this. I don't think any of us do. We've always respected our president, whether it was Reagan or Bush or Democrats, always, if we criticize him, it was criticism within bounds. And that's how it was when people criticized me. We could go out afterwards and have a drink and chat about it, laugh about it sometime. But with this fella, you can't do that because there's something deranged about him. I hate to use language like that, but that's the only way to describe it. And so we're in this jam now.
Ted, I'm going to stop you there for a second, because this is where I want you to go. Because you actually wrote, and Nestor may not be aware of this, you actually wrote a book once upon a time, a novel, about if presidential election isn't decided and it ends up in the House. I want you to talk about that book, because in the midst of all of this, and we can be dismissive of this president, and we can be disdainful of his behavior, but the reality is that his base, it's locked in at about 40, anywhere from 42% to 44%. Given the Electoral College, he could win again, particularly with the voter suppression efforts that he has underway. I'd like you to talk about that. So I'd like you to talk about his efforts to discredit the election, and then tie it into a book that you wrote once upon a time.
Well don't forget dismantling the post office, too, because that's the other part of this, right?
Yeah, right. Well, it's all part of the same thing, the vote suppression. But well, let's talk about that for a moment, and we'll get to the book and the implications of what he's trying to do now. The way, and I'd like to comment on this, the way fascism grows in a society, it's never happened here, and it probably won't. But it doesn't start as fascism. It starts in a small way where the country has economic issues, as Germany did after World War II, and Italy and Spain and all the European countries. And it develops where a leader emerges who has a certain charismatic and makes promises and gets away with things. And then gradually that leader takes over the judicial system, the military system, the intelligence system, the Gestapo or the stormtroopers or whatever, gradually takes over these major institutions, particularly the judicial system, which essentially in most societies has the handles the rule of law. And as we have seen this here, intelligence guys have resisted him. The only guys that haven't right now is Barr at the Judiciary Department, which is really caved in, and which is a shame. And Barr will have his comeuppance at some point. He's very clever, but he's also makes a lot of errors, and they backfired on him. So in any event, that's where we are. We're at the point where we've got to cut him off, and we're fortunate we have an election coming up. So what does he want to do? Right now, most of what they're trying to do is backfired in terms of he does have that base. It's disappointing to me that it's that high. I have a sense that it's a little smaller, maybe closer to the 38%, below the 40 level, as evidence in the 2018 election. We swamped him in that election, and the base did not deliver because I don't believe it's ever been as high as they think. However, they are loud, and they are mean, and they carry weapons into state houses, you know? I mean, this is just unheard of in our society. So now he's trying to discredit the potential election in a number of ways. He's trying to limit or suppress voting. They've done that all over the country. Sometimes they succeed, sometimes they don't. But Don, you're right, because of the electoral system, they don't have to succeed too much in some states. All they have to do is get the majority. They carry the electors, and that will determine who gets the 270 electors. So they're trying to suppress voting. How do they do that? Well, they want to cut funding in the post office department because they don't want them to mail out ballots or deliver things and hurt them. That is ridiculous. Post office system has been operating in this country for centuries, and we've treasured it. They've been fair. They've always been honest. No one's had any scandals over there. I always worked there during the Christmas holidays when I was at college to make some money. But in any event, they want to stop the post or curtail the post office department. They don't want mailing. You know what? Mailing an absentee ballot are the same thing. And he keeps saying, President, absentee ballots are good. I vote absentee ballot. Mailing your ballots in is not good. It is the exact same thing. And it really disrupts me when the pundits who are quoting him don't remind us of that. There is absolutely no distinction between a mail-in ballot and an absentee ballot. You fill a form out, and you send it in. And if you request one, you get one. Now, we want to improve it and give people an opportunity to do it because of the epidemic now, but it's the same as an absentee ballot. So they're trying to discredit that whole system, which is really unfortunate. So there's a whole bunch of things that they're doing. It's going to be a rigged election. We've been through all that. He's invited meddling from the outside. We've been through that. And so the question is, will he succeed? And then the ultimate, he says, the two ultimates, the election should be delayed, or I'm not going to honor the election. No president in the history of this country has ever said they would not honor an election, and that includes Richard Nixon, who had the patriotism to bow out at an appropriate time, and Lyndon Johnson, who decided to give it up when it wasn't working.
Well, there'll be no patriotism here. I mean, there will probably be armed guards and militia to escort him out, right? Like, there's no point where he's going to go out and with the umbrella over himself and not his wife and wave to the American people and say thank you and good night, right? There's no chance of that happening, none.
Lester, I'm tending to disagree with you. And I think he's going to go out. First of all, let's hope it's a landslide. But if it isn't, I'm with Nancy Pelosi, who said when they asked her, will he leave? She said, listen, we're going to, on January the 20th, if he doesn't leave, we're going to escort him out and then fumigate the White House. She's at the end of her rope, you know, with this.
You think that was a little Italy talk in there, right?
Yeah,
That was a little bit of Italy coming in.
Exactly. Right. But let me answer Don's question on what could happen. There are a series of things. The election will take place. The winner is really maybe announced, but it's never the winner. This business about it's a delayed vote. The winner occurs in December when the electors meet. They meet sometime in December, first, second week. I'm not sure. The electors gather. They don't gather at one place. They gather in their individual states. They cast their votes, and then they send them to the Secretary of State, who delivers them to the Congress. And the Congress then announces the formal results. Now, if no decision is made on the in the Electoral College, let's say there's they each get 270 votes. I think that's the thing. It's tied. That's the only way it can go to the House of Representatives today. It could go there if there were three candidates and the three candidates split it and nobody got the 270. That's what happened in 1801 when Jefferson and Burr were actually tied in the Electoral College. That you'd think that Jefferson and Burr being tied with Jefferson was just implausible. But the politics, the Federalist Party, jumped on Burr to stop Jefferson. And by the way, it then goes to the House. The House doesn't vote by individuals. It votes by states. Each state has one vote. Today, California would have one. Delaware would have one. It's a very interesting process. And by the way, while this is going on, the Senate is picking a vice president separately, individually. Don't have to be of the same party. So the House gathers to pick a president. And you need a majority of the House, so you need 26 states to vote in a president if it's a tied vote. Their vote. Today, if that election went to the House of Representatives, and that would occur, by the way, if the electors tied, go to the House of Representatives, in the House, the states would make the determination one state at a time, one vote. Today, if the existing Congress voted, the Republicans would have 26 states, the Democrats would have 23, and there would be one tie. So the Republicans could control the election today, but that doesn't happen. The next Congress will determine the election. The new sworn-in Congress, which will be on January the 3rd. On January 3rd, when the House meets and they're all sworn in, they pick their speaker, and they will obviously pick the House. Democrats are going to have the majority, but they still may not have a majority of the states. My sense is they probably will with what will occur. And therefore, oddly enough, if on January 20th he doesn't leave, and there's no president, the Speaker of the House automatically becomes the president. So Donald Trump, if he plays too many games here, could end up making Nancy Pelosi president. I don't think that's going to happen, but it would be a great tale if it did. Baltimore would have.
Now, was that the theme? Was that the theme of your book, Ted, that you wrote?
Yes, although my book didn't go that far. My book just dealt with what happened twice. You know, no one really realized that the House of Representatives can end up picking a president. They ended up picking Jefferson, by the way, the House. And this is the great story. It was Alexander Hamilton was an opposite position to Jefferson. He did not like Burr. He thought if it was a choice between Jefferson, he didn't like Jefferson either. And Burr, Jefferson was a man of principle. He would urge his Federalists. He wasn't in office to vote for Burr. All he had to do was he turned one congressman who had a single vote, the congressman from Delaware named James Bayard. There are a couple streets named after him in Delaware, by the way. He persuaded him to change his vote to Jefferson. That got Jefferson to the 26 votes. And it pissed Burr off so much that that's what caused the duel, ultimately.
I feel like we need to have the soundtrack to Hamilton playing in the background here.
Oh, we should. Oh, man, I love that.
You I'll tell you the room where it happened.
The other great song is that King George, You'll Be Back. Oh, that is such a great, great song. It's really,
Disney
I mean,
Plus.
That guy is just so good. You'll
Disney Plus
back.
For all of you who haven't been able to get.
Oh yeah, you got to see it, right? Or get the soundtrack, whatever. But in any event, so that's what happened. And one more thing, I think, just to conclude this. On January the 20th, there should be a reasonable. He should leave, and then Biden will then assume the presidency. And that would conclude the story. If he doesn't leave and he wants to fight, it would be like a banana republic with a coup. But you need a coup. You need the military behind you. I don't think that's going to happen today. I think the military realized their mistake in Lafayette Park. And they may follow him in some ways, but the full military is not going to go with him now. This paramilitary that he's got, particularly the ICE guys in the border, those border guys are pretty vicious. They're really not trained in crowd control, and he might be able to drag them along. I'm not so sure the Secret Service would go with him. The only problem with the Secret Service is both all these groups that he's got, 15, 20 different paramilitary groups, are controlled by different agencies. And he's got the sycophant bar in the Judicial Department, which covers some of them, like Secret Service and FBI. And he's got this guy Wolf, and this other guy in the Homeland Security. These guys are absolute Nazis. I mean, and so that's the only thing we have to be careful about. My own sense is that there will be enough rebellion in these various places that they're not going to go along with him. Unless it's so close that you have a legitimate argument and he might be able to persuade someone. But I think even then, this country is much too strong and too patriotic to allow a single man like this to overturn its two-century development. I may be wrong. Maybe I'm too much of an optimist. But I will take up arms if need be to make sure that this country, like our founding fathers, to create and maintain the democracy. So let's hope.
Amen to that. Hey, Ted, while we've got you've been prominently mentioned. Nestor and I have been on this bandwagon now for probably 6 to 9 months. The whole issue of Save the Sun and the sad commentary in terms of what's happening to the Baltimore Sun that we all love. Nestor worked there, grew up there. Basically, it's where his journalistic chops began. Give us an update from your perspective. You're part,
sure.
part of the group that's been working. Let us know where we are on that.
Well, we are where we were. It all started years ago with Bob Embry and Walter Sondheim and I when we tried to buy it when it was up originally, but did not succeed, and we tried with every new owner. This particular, where we are now, is it owned by a hedge fund that does what most hedge funds do. They are responsible for making profit for their shareholders, and so they try to do it any way they can because advertising has dropped in newspaper, and because of the digitalization of life, they make their revenue by cutting their staff and cutting their news hole. And that's what's been happening, and it's really really a shame because it is an institution. It's, to me, like a ball club, a sporting team, the Orioles, the Ravens. If we were to lose them, we do anything to keep them. Remember, we bought seat licenses and season tickets when we lost the Colts, and losing the Sun for our city would be a really, I think it would cap, it would stop us from being a major league city. You can't be a major league city without a responsible, regional, powerful newspaper that is produces guys like Nestor and covers stories, not just covers stories and goes into depth, but is also a cheerleader, a place where you can get your news. I remember, I still have clippings of the photography, the pictures that they did when I was coaching the Red Shield Boys Club, 10 to 12 little piggyback team, and we played at the stadium, the National Piggyback Championship, and I still have clippings of that. That's how important the newspapers were. I've always wanted to thank the photographers who did that shooting, whoever the sporting guys send them out. But that's really how important a paper is. So right now, they, the hedge company, we have a group ready to buy the paper if it was for sale. The problem is it's not for sale. Well, in any event, we have been trying to negotiate with the firm. There's been a very strong group that has come together, the former Sun Paper veterans, the existing Sun Paper, the union, the guild, their National Communication Workers Union. And it's really mobilized citizen, everyone from Westmore to Brooks Robinson and folks like that have all come behind the idea of trying to save the Sun and bring it under local ownership. And by the way, what we would do with it, if we were able to negotiate a sale, we would have not only local ownership, we would turn it into a nonprofit. I think that is the way paper should be going today. The model of the old private ownership just isn't working, and a nonprofit might be better, better kind of model to sustain a newspaper in the future, simply because advertising revenues are down. You have to be able to turn it into some kind of a digital enterprise. You have to rely on donations, like public broadcasting, I think, would be the pattern. So we've got to save it. We can't have a big league town without it. And the effort that is, it's a major effort, but until they want to sit down and negotiate, they are making money, by the way, and in some ways, they don't want to particularly sell paper like the Sun that is making money in spite of its difficulties, laying off, furloughing people. The people there are really working like hell to make it. I mean, they're spending a lot of time. They're working overtime. They're doing two or three shifts. I mean, they are working really hard to make that paper as the way it is, at least to bring it to some level. It's not where it once was. But they are real. We got to give them credit, and we only hope these guys would sit down. But they don't want to give up the cash flow from a paper because it helps them pay off their debt or pay their shareholders. That's why we think going into a nonprofit is really the way to go. So that's where we are. It's where we were when we started, except we have had discussions both, they just said, look, if we're interested, we'll get back to you.
and that's where it stands. The other problem would be if they wanted an outlandish price. We're not going to pay that. Nobody wants to be the owners of a paper and be the ones who close it, particularly if we're local. That's not how Bob and I want to go out. So anyhow, we'll have to wait and see if we ever get to a point of negotiation. Right now, the thing to do is to go on the website, join the group, and keep the pressure on these folks. The whole purpose of the pressure is to get them to come to the table so we can negotiate an arrangement, bring the paper to local ownership, and turn it into a nonprofit. So that's where we are.
Well, Ted, stay safe over there on the beach. And, you know, we got a lot of fight in you and certainly a lot of fight ahead. You'll be making your way back here to the city at the end of the summer here. And beach life good over in Eastern Shore? Everything okay over there?
Oh, yeah. No, it's great. But today you can fight from wherever you want. You know, it's a lot of people are going to know this after this. They're going to be working from home a lot more often, I think. So anyhow, the beach is great. We're doing well. Enjoy being with you guys. You've got a great program. Keep it up. It's really a worthwhile institution for our region. It really is. The city needs help, guys, and you really participate in it. I would hope, by the way, one final comment. The city cannot make it alone. The region has to support it. The county execs from all of whom are pretty good, ought to really develop a real strong program to kick in. I don't mean just verbally. I mean there's got to be institutional help, financial help. There's got to be a different way of looking at the region. The city, just today, in the way the cities have to operate and the costs and the expenditures and the problems and the police forces and the fire forces, the frontline people, the way the medical institutions have to operate with so many problems, they need regional assistance. And we've got to recognize that, because as we can see, whatever the problems are in the city, get to the suburbs. There's no escape. We can't look at it that way. We have to look at it as one region, not a regional government. Forget that. Everybody can have their executive, their mayor, their council, their delegates. We don't want to disrupt that. But there's got to be a regional, and not just the regional groups that are out there now, there's got to be a different sense and a different philosophy about what our city means to us, what this port means to us. There's got to be groups like Trade Point. They do a terrific job. They have a sense of the region. And that's the kind of attitude that we need in this region. I hope it emerges. We've got some good executives. Johnny O is doing a great job. And we just have to push ourselves. I know if I had stayed, I was going to put on our tax form. This has been a very radical idea. A little note that said, if you want to contribute to a Baltimore City trust fund, just check here and the amount here. And the taxpayer could have decided whether they wanted $5 or $10 to go to this fund. But it would have created more of an intention to help the city. Now, I don't know if it would have worked, if I could have passed it or whatever it is, but it's that kind of thinking that needs to take place now in terms of the help that we're giving, that we give the city. And that's why you guys are so valuable. You are pointing out some of the great things about the city, but we need more than this kind of verbal activity. We really need the Harbor Place has got to be rebuilt. I'm stuttering because I'm really exasperated.
There's a long list, Ted.
There's a long list. You're exactly right. And I hope our new mayor immediately gets hold of these executives and creates some kind of a system where there is continuing contact. And the executives come to grips with the fact that if they don't help the city and include them in their budgets as if it was a line budget, a Department of Recreation and Parks, school system, city's got to be treated that way. They need help.
Ted, we appreciate you, man. Get some rest here this summer. We'll get you feisty just in time for the mail-in and the election here in a couple of weeks. We'll get you back. Don, okay. Any parting shot for your former county executive?
No, not at all. We're going to have Ted come back, talk about what the Brandon Scott administration should look like. We'll get into updates on the election as we get closer. So, Ted, we look forward to you being a regular contributor on Baltimore.
Well,
give Lynn our best and stay safe.
Okay, I don't want to leave without saying, Don, how great you were as county executive in that brief interim.
Oh, thank you.
Really, really helped make that continuum from all the previous executives, particularly from our friend Kevin.
Keep up
the good work.
Thanks, Ted.
Okay?
Appreciate you. Ted Vanatulis, former Baltimore County executive, publisher of the Towson Times. He could be sunning himself over in Eastern Shore. Instead, he's really, really feisty out on Facebook about this president, this election, this virus, and the pathway out. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, my partner here at WNST.net, Towson, Baltimore, we are calm, we are local, and we are Baltimore Positive.